Good morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry. Kind of got my water wings out here. It's a little wet. We've had rain practically more on than off. It's about 5 o'clock yesterday. So the flooding problems we have in the northern suburbs of Chicago reared their ugly head again starting last night. But down here, it's just a little wet, and it's going to clear probably in time for me to see my ball game. The Cardinals playing the Cubs at Wrigley about 3 o'clock. So that's what we got going here in Chicago.
Well, we've got a perfect day here in Austin. I'm actually in town. I spent the night in town with my friends Jay and Ashley, and they have superb Wi-Fi. So we've got that going for us. Yeah.
Very, very good.
I got Wi-Fi. So we got a big day today.
Yeah.
So, you know, are you suited up? Are you suited up, John?
You know what? Yesterday I did my laundry, and as I washed, I must have been about 6 or 7 shirts. I was taking them out of the dryer. I felt my shirt that was so much different, so soft, so smooth, that it was just so unique. The Bro Show T-shirt. Yes, I am wearing it. Wow. It's got a special texture, which the softness is just cuddly. It's sort of like squeeze the Charmin. You feel a need to squeeze this shirt. That's how soft and comfortable it is.
Well, that's crazy, because Jay and Ashley have them too. So we were talking about this fabric, and you know what he said was interesting. He said, you know, we used to have these like really kind of thick cotton T-shirts that were like. He said, they feel like cardboard now.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm the same way. I'm totally spoiled. So sooner or later, I'm gonna convert probably, and most of my T-shirts are going to be like this because I just can hardly stand those other ones. But anyways, here we are. We're suited up, ready to go. And we've got unsung heroes today we're going to talk about.
Yes, I mean, we realized as we were going through the possibilities this week that, you know, John McCain, you know, who's has his challenges right now with respect to cancer, which we can relate to.
Totally.
Is also he's a hero. And I think a lot of people don't realize how great this man is in terms of the things he had to endure during the Vietnam War as a prisoner of war. So we felt that we don't want to talk too much about John because, you know, at this point, we don't want to make this a eulogy.
No,
because John is, if there's a man who can face the challenge of cancer any better, he's better equipped to do it. There's nobody more than John McCain.
Right.
So as you read in the newspaper about the fact that it demonstrates what we've talked about before about cancer. And the fact is that this is a very aggressive form of brain cancer he has. And if you look at the stats, it might look kind of bleak where you see maybe 10-15% of surviving more than 5 years. But the bottom line is, the bottom line is John is the man. I mean, if a person is going to do it, John is the person.
Yeah.
So, thought a little bit about, John McCain. So, So with that in mind, we felt, you know, there's other guys out there who, you know, throughout the years, maybe they either were delayed as being recognized as heroes or maybe people just don't even know about them, how great some of these people are. And we picked a couple.
Yeah.
And that's who we want to talk about today.
Absolutely. These guys are fantastic. It's astounding. We'll start with an Englishman. Well, actually, there are two Englishmen, aren't they? I just realized.
Yes, they are. One had,
One
went to Princeton for a bit, spent some time in the U.S. But the first one we're going to talk about, Sir Nicholas Winton.
Yes,
is an incredible story. It's a heartbreaking story. Both of these individuals have come to the forefront to some extent based upon movies. In the case of Sir Nicholas Winton, his story has been told in several different movies, but probably the best one is Nicky's Children, is it called?
Yep.
That was a docudrama that came out several years ago that brought forth this man's place in history in terms of World War II. This is sort of the setting. So Jerry, I don't know if you want to start.
Yeah,
with giving a little bit of the background.
I'll dig into this a little bit. Yeah, it's hard to kind of find a spot. I'm going to start at the end, and because I think this is interesting. This man lived a middle upper class kind of Englishman, stiff upper lip kind of guy. One day his wife, I don't have all the details, but his wife was rummaging around in the attic and she found a scrapbook that she'd never seen before. And she started looking through it. And it had pictures and documents and all kinds of stuff of something that Nicholas went and did that she knew nothing about. He did it during the war, right as the war was starting. He and a friend were vacationing in Prague, and they were kind of confronted with the fact that there were all these Jewish families trying to get their kids out of the country because they knew what was coming. And it is a really unbelievably heartbreaking, selfless act. And he was, of course, moved. And he himself was a convert from Judaism to Church of England, I believe. So this kind of touched something in him and woke something up in him. And then when he got back to England, he just, it was like he caught on fire. He couldn't, he just couldn't stand what was going on over there. So he set up this unbelievable mechanism, against all odds, I might add, to get these kids out of there because they were having a lot of trouble. He organized, first I think they airlifted a bunch of them out, and then he switched to trains. And it's just unbelievable what he had to go through to do this. And part of it was Prague and Czechoslovakia, but actually a great deal of it was from England itself. They had all these crazy rules. And of course, hey, you know, they were anticipating being, you know, at war. Well, they're at war. And they were nervous about letting people in the country. And the U.S. and England were not, I don't think they were as open-hearted as they could have been toward the plight of the Jewish people.
Yeah, I think the challenge we have here is a setting. We're talking late 1938, so, you know, Hitler's troops are marching in various places, but officially not at war with all of Czechoslovakia. So he's got this window of opportunity, which is not very long.
Closing.
And we've also got the geographic challenges of going across Germany to Netherlands to get into England. But the biggest challenge, as you've pointed out, is finding a place for these kids to land. We're talking about children that are in Czechoslovakia that are Jewish. And the challenges lie in the fact that he had to place these kids before he could actually officially get them a home. They had to be put in a home with foster parents. And that was the bottleneck, as you've pointed out. It's sad in a way. And believe me, we could talk Holocaust stories, and we're not here to try to say one is more, you know, tragic than the other, because number one, I don't know enough. I'm not an expert, but the case is that you've got, when you're talking kids, you know, it gets to be a pretty heartbreaking story.
Yeah.
So
they had this. They kind of focused on one woman in the movie. And by the way, we're spoiling all over the place for this movie if you haven't seen it. So if you want to see it, go watch it and come back. And we're going to do the same with the other movie too, because they're fairly contemporary. A lot of the other movies we do are really old, so everybody's seen them or what have you. But I think it's common sense, but I'll just say it out loud. But in particular, they focused on this one woman, and she was really, really torn. She just couldn't give up her little girl. And it was just heartbreaking. In the end, you know, this kid went in and out of a window of a train as it was moving a couple times because she couldn't make up her mind. And her daughter didn't want to leave, of course, didn't really understand. I mean, how are you going to explain this to a kid? These people grew up as, you know, well-to-do, prosperous people. They worked hard. They built families. They were Czechoslovakian as far as they were concerned. Of course, they also practiced Jewish faith, most of them, but still, you know, they were citizens, and they thought, but they knew, they'd already heard what had happened in Germany to their brothers and sisters over there, so they knew, well, this is gonna be bad, and so they didn't think they could get themselves out, and they couldn't, but they could get their kids out, and this Nicholas Winton set up a whole mechanism, a whole organization there in England. And they show all the documentation, what he had to go through to do it. They had to get a family. They had to sign. I think there was some money involved, too. So much money had to be put up.
Well, yeah, I mean, the bottlenecks, there's the logistic bottleneck of finding the families, but there's also the financial challenge of, number one, the transportation of these children, because they had to pay train fares, and quite often the parents were unable to come up with the money. So, you know, there's recruiting to get the placement of the kids, but there's also the financial challenges of getting them from Czechoslovakia, Prague, over into England. You know, the other thing I don't want to understate, and you've mentioned, is the fact is we've got the emotional challenges that these parents have, realizing that what they're doing is they're giving up their children. And based upon the climate as it existed in Europe at the time, knowing that they probably were not ever going to live to see their children again.
Yep.
So just think about your about trying to part with somebody like that under those circumstances. It's very emotional. There's no doubt about
it. Yeah, emotional and mind-boggling that these are brave people. They did a very, very hard thing. They put their kids first. And, of course, you know, people do that, but this is to an extreme. And, you know, you go through the process of them being they're waiting at a train station, you know, and they're being processed and put through, and all this stuff. And the poor little kids are all tired and beat up, and then they get placed in, and they're all, a lot of them are, you know, maybe they were friends before, but now they're scattered all over. A lot of them are rural England, which was smart.
Right.
And that's what they did in London, too, that a lot of people sent their kids into the countryside with relatives so that less chance of them being bombed. So,
well,
it's a tough situation, to say the least.
I would say that, you know, we call Sir Nicholas a unsung hero, and he sort of brings that upon himself because he feels a frustration about the fact he doesn't think so much about the almost 700 children that he's able to save. He thinks more about the 15,000 Jewish children that are left.
Yeah.
That obviously have a fate which is not very good. In addition, and that is kind of climaxed by the fact that he sees the 250 children that were the last group that he was able to get out. And this is, you know, middle of 1939. But they don't get out.
No,
The Germans stopped. And he, you know, he realizes that their plight, their fate is pretty bleak. So he carries this, the thoughts and the images of these children with him, and that is what is kind of left this story kind of by the wayside. And fortunately, his wife, like you mentioned, was able to take the dust off that book and then give it to a Holocaust historian who then, you know, made this story, broke the story and allowed it to kind of surface and become, and to the point that he was, you know, honored in a variety of ways, including by the Queen Elizabeth being knighted, etc.
That last scene. Yeah, it's really moving. What they did was they kind of tricked him a little bit. He was elderly at this point. This was what year, John, when they had the get together, the reunion?
Well, I don't know. It's in, I think, the late 90s.
Yeah.
You have to understand, this fellow lived to the age of 106 to 2015. So, a great guy. And he did have an element of this philanthropy and helping people that continued through his life, in addition to also continuing his career in finance. But, the good news is he lived long enough to see his work rewarded.
Yes, but they all got, this is a really cool scene toward the end of the movie, and there's lots of other peripheral information you can get on YouTube. You can see all kinds of clips surrounding this, but the big one was at the end, they had this kind of get-together, and he didn't know all the details of it, and he attended. And he's surrounded by all these people, and there's a speaker up front, and she discloses that what happened to her during the war, and that Nicholas Winton saved her life. and got her out of Prague. And then they keep going with the story, and he said, and he she introduces the woman to his left, and she, of course, these kids had never met him, most of them, or if they were so young, they didn't, yeah, didn't remember when they saw him going through, you know, when he was processing him. And so he discovers this woman to his left is one of the children he saved. And then she said, would all the people who either he saved or children of the people he saved, please stand up. And the entire auditorium stood up. And then he stood up, turned around, and this he was, tears are flowing from his face, and all these people were hugging and loving him, and, you know, in their kind of reserved English way. But a lot of these kids, I think, they were just raised English, and they kind of assimilated, which is crazy.
Yeah, if you take the 700, almost 700 kids that he saved, and then you consider the families which those children had, he clearly touched the lives of well over 5,000 people. And that, yeah, you know, that's a, yeah, you're right, the emotion is overwhelming.
But so, it's a, there's an unsung hero for sure. This guy did something monumental against a lot of odds. He showed, like, he showed incredible humility. Even when all the story came out and all that stuff. And, you know, he just thought, I think part of him, just it was obvious from listening to him talk, that he thought, well, why wouldn't somebody do this? That's the question. The question isn't that I'm so great that I did this. It's why wasn't everybody doing this? This is so obvious. It's so needed and all that stuff. And part of it's communication. And part of it is the fact that the country, I'm not trying to make excuses, but England was, you know, UK was just, they were going to go through another war, and it had only been how many years, 15 years or so before they just done this before.
Right.
So yeah, bad situation, but these kids got saved and they were happy, and they were happy to see him, and they had thrived. Some of them had gone over to, after the war, gone to the United States to stay with relatives over there. They were contacted. Everybody got together. This is quite an undertaking to get all that together into. And the movie is good. It's a good movie. It's not like the one we're going to talk about in a minute, which is a really well-produced, great actors and all this. These were people that, by and large, you've never seen in a movie. And it was well done. It wasn't bad at all. It was good. It's worth watching. But, yeah, they kind of reenacted a lot of this stuff. So they had actors, and they had, you know, they were all in costume for the period. And they did a good job, I think, of framing it. I felt like, you know, you're back there. And it was excellent. It was a really good movie. It's worth watching, definitely worth watching. And the story is worth thinking about, especially in the kind of days we're living in today, is that, you know, we need some heroes. And these stories are great to follow anytime. But I think, you know, people tend to get a little discouraged when things aren't going their way with all these issues about healthcare and education and the economy and politics. Good to see somebody who really stood up for what was right. And so, great movie.
I think that Winton realized that the bottleneck was the big challenge. And if there's and what makes the story even sadder is that he reached out to other countries, including a letter to FDR, to try to work so that he could get more recruit more families. And
yes.
England is, if there's another hero in this, it's got to be England. They're the ones who step up to the plate and delivered. While,
yep,
unfortunately, some of these other countries, which we're not trying to badmouth any, you know, the rest of the world,
sure,
they
sure,
surely
sure
had their problems at the time, and priorities had to be set by what they were going to do. But, you know, England also has to be given some accolades,
yep,
for their participation in this effort.
No. Yeah, and the Netherlands too, you know.
Right.
My daughter, John's niece, is over there, and my grandchild and her family is in visiting over there and stuff like that. Her husband, Jan, he and I will watch war movies sometimes, and there's quite a few good movies, and he likes the ones where they talk about the Dutch resistance and all the stuff they did. They did tremendous work over there to save Jewish families, hide them, move them, all kinds of stuff. They had a stiff resistance to the Germans. They did not get invaded in World War I because they flooded one-third of Amsterdam, a circle around the city, so they couldn't get in. and couldn't really make any kind of a beachhead at all in the Netherlands, but they couldn't do that in World War II because Germany was more mechanized. And so, you know, they did get invaded, but they did not like it, and they did resist, and they did stuff like this. They got these kids through the Netherlands, and they got them onto the, you know, the English Channel and across to, over to England. And that was not easy stuff to do. So, you know, hats off to those guys, too. They're in the war. They should be proud, and they are for good reason. Good people over there. Yeah, so fantastic. Good stuff.
Yes, without a doubt. Let's move on to our other unsung hero, which is it's on a much bigger scale in terms of movies and story. It's incredible.
Once again, World War II.
Yes, a setting that starts towards the beginning of the war in the 1941-42. This one is the movie that came out. It's called The Imitation Game. So, Jerry, maybe you'd like to give a little background as to how this one revs up.
Well, this is one of my personal heroes. Alan Turing, the man who this movie centers around, is a remarkable individual. And anybody who's done any kind of computer science at all in school or in their trade or whatever know about Alan Turing. It's like part of our DNA. And you know, the really great thing about I will just say, almost entirely, the technical community, they are people who are, let's just say it, you know, back when we were coming up, if you study computer science, then you were probably what they call now a nerd. And so, you know, you had your challenges in high school. Maybe you got pushed around a little bit, got made fun of, you had thick glasses, you wore a pocket protector, who knows what. But in any case, you know, one of the things that gets you through stuff like that is heroes. And so, you know, going through high school that, yeah, I know what that feels like when you're marginalized, when you're not recognized and all that stuff. And so there's in the technical community, there's a great deal of support for anybody who's marginalized, and they stand up. And, you know, you see more and more of it, with these big companies. They participate in the pride parades in San Francisco, and you know they're big supporters, and they use their economic clout to defeat these transgendered bathroom laws that they're trying to, like here in Texas, they can't pass this law. they can't, and they want to, something fierce, you know, but they can't do it because the economic threats are so great that they would lose too much business to do it. So they are not going to get this bill through. And, you know, a couple other states in the South tried it, and they were, you know, huge games and all kinds of sports and events and stuff like that were just, like, totally canceled. Forget it. We're not coming to your state.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody feels it. And a lot of that is, you know, the tech community has been very vocal in that stuff, and they're a big part of the economy. So we came up knowing who Alan Turing was, and it's a sad, sad story. But story of a hero, and this guy did some amazing stuff. He was definitely a genius. He got his standing, his academic standing, young. And as John said, he also went to Princeton,
PhD Princeton. So he has a U.S. piece to him, which is really significant. In fact, is the book The Imitation Game was released through the Princeton University Press.
Yes.
So but the story, his story is amazing. As we take a look at the movie and also the background, the factual background, is that we're confronted with a situation that we're so frustrating. We can get all these messages. We can, this thing, the Germans, a whole way of communicating was by means of a thing called Enigma, which was their way of sending codes out. The bottom line is that the U.S., you know, England could easily intercept all this information. The problem is they couldn't decipher it. And to make things even more frustrating was that the information, the coding they did was changed daily. So you
daily,
get to
yes.
the point where you think, you know, well, we can solve this. It's just a matter of time. Well, you're on a time bomb because, you see, after 24 hours, you got to start it all over again. I was also intrigued by the way they recruited some of these people to become part of the team to try to decode Germany. They basically put a contest together, said, if you can solve this crossword puzzle, you know, a certain period of time, send the crossword puzzle in and you'll win a trip to London free for two. So that's the way they recruited like many of these people.
Well, the star of this recruiting effort was a woman, which was unheard of. In fact, she had trouble getting into the room to take the final test because they didn't believe her. They thought that the secretarial pool was upstairs, you know, and she had to fight to kind of get in the room. And Alan Turing immediately stood up for her and got her in the room. And she finished this test that they had, which was incredibly hard. It had to be done in, what, six minutes?
Because that's minutes. How long. And Turing did it in 6 minutes, she did it like in 5 minutes. And he looked at her like, you know, like, you did it faster than I did. Give me a break.
Yeah, but boy, she got on the team, and they put just a small team together. And their job was they had 18 hours every day to solve, to come up with the key. They had to get the key for the encryption. And it's a multi-step process. It's not simple. And so not only is it hard, but it's not a simple process. They had to figure out a way to be able to figure out the key so that they could decode these encrypted messages, which were sent in the clear. They were not trying to hide these messages. No. They were going out. And so anyone could intercept them, but you had to have the key and an Enigma machine, which they did get off of a submarine, by the way. And so they got an Enigma machine somehow, by hook or by crook. And they even had, there's a backstory in that too. They had to really go through all kinds of stuff to get this machine off of a submarine and make it look like the machine went down with the submarine and that they didn't have it. So they had to like do a double blind thing here so the Germans didn't think they had an Enigma machine. And they were very confident that they would never get decrypted because they had a really good system. So what are you going to do? We got, what, five people? Six people, I think, and they had to find a way to do this in 18 hours. And immediately, Turing knew exactly what to do because he'd written papers and had this idea that he could build a computing machine that could do calculations and figure out the key. He was confident in it, and he had to do 159 million million permutations and combinations of keys in order to get the key that could crack the Enigma for that day. So he had 18 hours to do it, and he thought, humans can't do this. This needs to be a machine. And everybody thought he was full of hooey. And they tried to get rid of him and fire him. And he went straight to Winston Churchill with a letter. And Churchill said, not only is this guy on the team, but he's now head of the team. Do what he says. And so he built this machine.
Yeah.
For £100,000, which is an insane amount of money at that time. And they built an Enigma machine. You got to see this thing to believe it. And it's, a computing machine. And they still have it. And you can go to Bletchley and see it. And it's a real
Bletchley's
thing.
Yeah, Bletchley's the place about 50 miles northwest of London. It was a big complex. There's like, we might think of an industrial, you know, a business court of, this is comparable to that, except it's kept in beautiful shape. You can tour it. And the machine that was used, that was recreated in the movie, was considered so good looking, so authentic looking, that it has become a part of the museum.
Yes.
There. And it's incredible. I think that one of the things that you kind of, it's not clear in the movie, but to me, it's a big piece of it, is that they realized that they needed to give their computing machine, as they were not making the time limit of 18 hours, they need to give it a little help.
I guess the best way
of describing this,
yeah.
Well, what they did is sort of like say, well, let's think like Sherlock Holmes. There's got to be logic here somewhere. So let's look for pieces that we can give and kind of center and guide the computer through.
It's more than
so
guide.
That we can eliminate.
They had to find a way to filter, because you can't do you can't do 159 million million calculations in 18 hours with the technology they had then. They just couldn't do it. They tried, and every time they had trouble getting the machine up and running. Once they got that running, they couldn't do it in the period of time. So they had to find a way to lower the number of calculations that the machine had to do, and they had to really lower it by quite a bit. And they couldn't figure out a way to do it, couldn't figure out a way to do it. And how did they do it, John? You remember?
Well, I mean, yeah, not exactly. I remember, you know, what we've talked about, the fact that the filtering was able to come down to it, but maybe you can...
Yeah, okay. This is kind of cool. So I don't remember the exact circumstances and who came up with it. It was kind of a team effort, but I think it was the woman character played by Keira Knightley. She said she noticed that, you know, we got to find something that's in every message. And she was talking to one of her friends at a bar with the team.
Oh, yeah.
And they said, well, she says, I've got kind of a crush on this German, because all these guys, when they do their messages, which are done in Morse code, tap, 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 they all have a signature the way they tap. And so she really felt like you have these fantasy worlds when you're sitting hours and hours and hours and deciphering Morse code. She felt like she knew this guy. She was kind of talking about it. And then suddenly, Turing and this woman kind of almost simultaneously back and forth figured out there's something in common with all the messages. They all say Heil Hitler at the end. And there's always at the beginning of the day, a weather report. So they had a really discrete message, which was always going to be almost the same. So they took all the common elements of that message, you know, the time kind of event. And what the weather aspects of it, which are going to be common to every single one of these transmissions that this guy does. And then he always ends it in Heil Hitler. So now they know this is in every single one of these messages. And they were able to use that to get down from, you know, like 100 hours, which it would have taken or something like that, to, geez, I think like half an hour. They were able to, they lowered it by so much just by knowing this certain data that was in every single one of these. They were able to get the machine to figure out what the key was. Then they get the key and they go over to the Enigma machine and they start deciphering, and it works. And it's crazy.
Right. And it is. I mean, but the fact is that they were able to guide that through, like you said, knowing there were common elements going to be in the machine, and that way reduce the number of permutations that they had to go through.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the heart, you take a look at the machine, it's gigantic. I mean, it is so, but it's so good looking, but it's so old, that you realize that they were electric.
It was beautiful. Don't you think? I mean, go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm nerding out.
The twist and turns at this point are, then we've got it. We've got it made.
Mm-mm.
We can break it.
But not really.
No, a bigger challenge lies. The bigger challenge lies.
Here's the genius of Turing.
In making sure.
Here's the genius of Turing.
This is Turing thinking. I say, look, we've got a bigger challenge. Our challenge is to use the information we have in a way that Germany doesn't realize that we've broken the code.
Yes.
Because we don't want them to go and use a new way of doing it. We want them to be comfortable thinking that what they're doing in the terms of sending messages is successfully being done. So they had to be very, very, very selective.
Totally.
And also come up with backstories, this and that, that they could filter through back to the Germans to think that they were learning things by other means than breaking the code.
Oh, it was very tricky. And if that isn't enough, they also could not tell their superiors about this, because there's no way. I mean, right within the team, the first thing they decipher is there's a ship that's going to go down, and one of the team members' brother is on the ship, and they cannot save him. They can't do a damn thing.
Right.
And think about this. Think how hard this is to do. And I don't think anyone else but Turing would have thought of this or had the will to force everybody on the team to be completely quiet about this thing. And he said, we've got to be very careful, and here's what we're going to do. There was an MI6 guy. This is right when MI6 was invented. This is the intelligence agency for they're like the CIA in the United States. So this got formed, and there's this spook who works for them, a little creepy guy too. He's kind of scary. And so not that he's mean, but it's just that he's really got the mind of a spy. And they came to him and said, look, we're going to be very selective about what we give and everything like that. And you've got to make sure all this work seamlessly, and you've got to run the foil for us to make them think we don't know this, the Germans, and all this stuff. And so a lot of coordination had to take place. They had to bypass the whole British government and not let anyone know. And they just put it all in the hands of this one guy from MI6, and he did it. And the fact that they were able to decipher these things cut 2 years off of the war. 2 years. This is an incredible thing. It gets worse.
Yeah, the thing about the 2 years, obviously, is based upon a lot of assumptions. And, the 2 years could be argued, but obviously the significance of the event should not be undermined by the fact. I mean, I was reading somebody said,
well,
the
2 years, didn't he?
Well, yeah. My point being that, you know, a lot of naysayers would say, well, you know, we had this thing called the atomic bomb. Well, that's another way we could have maybe ended it prematurely in Europe, too.
Yeah.
If we had continued in Europe. But let's not get into the details. I mean, the point is, this is a very significant piece of what happened during the war.
It's
a part of history. And I think, you know, when you say unsung heroes, part of that lies in the fact that they were so embedded in keeping the secret that here we are. When does it finally hit the street? We're talking like 1970s, like 1974. Somebody writes a book that kind of tells the story.
Well, the Official Secrets Act kept everyone from talking about it. And there's another aspect of this, too, that's kind of interesting as well. They didn't want to break up the team, and they had a lot of difficulty working with the Keira Knightley character. To get her working with the team, she had to pretend like she's working in a secretarial pool because her parents wouldn't let her work with all these men. And finally, at one point, she's 25 years old, and her parents put up they pitched a fit and said, look, you know, you got to come home. You're 25 years old. You have no prospects there. We need to get you married. You're going to be an old maid if you're not careful. And so Turing said, no problem. We'll keep you here. Tell them you're going to marry me. And we're engaged. And he took some wire, made a ring out of it, put it on her finger. Now, Alan Turing is totally 100% gay. And he has no interest in a woman. But this woman...
That was a spoiler alert.
Well, we got that at the top. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
Everybody in the tech community knows.
We couldn't help but mention, you know what, we got to tell the whole story.
Yeah, you have to tell the whole story. Yeah. So, this is like... There's plots with this thing, challenges within challenges that they had overcome. And this is entirely accurate. So, yeah, she did that. They did that. So he didn't tell her he was gay. And no one on the team officially knew, but they all had their suspicions about him. But, you know, he did it. He did the right thing, and he saved her. She got to stay on the team, stay at Bletchley. And the cool part about this is that he actually did love her, and he loved her mind, because the way she was able to solve problems and think outside the box, and she loved him. They had a real thing, and it was, you know, just heartbreaking. And there was a time during the process where he confessed to her that he was, I'm a homosexual, is what he said, and he was deeply ashamed and felt terrible about it. And she just like rose right to the occasion and said, so what? I kind of thought you were anyway. What does that matter? We can still get married and do whatever we want to do. You know, yeah. I'm in love with your mind. You're in love with my mind. That's all that matters. And wow, you know, and this is true. This really happened. In that day and age, you know, you think everything's, well, almost like out of medieval times or something, because their social structure was so rigid. But here are these people. Man, I mean, that was really beautiful, really nice. But anyway, if you see the movie, you'll discover that he says, no, I don't love you and all this stuff, because he wanted her to have a life, and he didn't think she would have a life with him. And so that's another heartbreaking aspect of this. And he just sucked it up. And over again, this guy just sucks it up. He just takes it on the chin for his country. He's entirely patriotic. And he'll do whatever it takes to get the job done. And you see it like 4 or 5 times where he takes a stand. And this is all true, all accurate. And that's why all nerds love this guy. And it's just heartbreaking what happened to him. He got arrested, because
We're talking like 1951 or 52. So this is like five or six years after the war.
He had a lover who didn't really took exception. Just used him basically, and it came to the attention of the authorities. And that's what frames the movie. By the way, it starts out with him in a being interrogated in a police station, and this one police officer has a brain, and he wants to hear the story, and that's what the movie is him telling the story, and it's unbelievable. You have to watch this movie from the very first seconds, otherwise you won't catch it, because there's a lot of subtlety in this thing, and this you're entering into the mind, one of the great minds of the 20th century. So maybe more centuries than that. This guy was really sharp. And so he tells his story, but he does it in a very unique way. And that's where the name Imitation Game comes up. He plays a game with this police officer, and he puts it entirely in his hands. I'm going to leave you to judge whether I should be arrested. And it was really beautiful, really great. So you get to hear the whole story. In the end, he gets arrested. In the end, he gets a choice. You go to prison, and that was terrible because he would get separated from his machine, which was separated from his first crush he ever had on anybody, this guy Christopher, who died before they could even talk about how they felt about each other. So that he carried that his whole life, and he couldn't part from his machine Christopher, because if he did that, his friend would be dead. So he said, I'll do whatever it takes to avoid prison. So that meant chemical castration, and that's what he did. And at that time, chemical castration was horrific, and the side effects unbelievable, and his body suffered. He couldn't work. He couldn't hold things. And at the end, the woman from the team visited him because she had heard he was in bad shape, and she just couldn't believe, you know, what had happened to him. And shortly after that, he commits suicide, but Alan Turing even did that in stellar fashion. His favorite story when he was a kid was Sleeping Beauty, so he put cyanide in an apple, ate the apple, and died. Boom.
Wow.
Yeah. Nobody knew. No, and this is unsung, as John said, until it got broken in 25 years later almost. And then, you know, after that, okay, the story's out. Nerds knew the story all along. They didn't know all of it, but they knew enough to get upset. And now the nerd community really gets crazy, and they start a full-blown campaign to get him pardoned and to get him exonerated and get him recognized. And it took a while.
So, you know, the thing is that the movie comes out like 2014. So we've got 1974. But in 1974, when the whole story breaks, it breaks more about the fact that they had broken
the
German code, the Enigma. They had broken it. But what was not brought to the forefront was who was the main player, the key player in that, and that's Alan Turing.
Yeah.
That doesn't come out until 10 years later when a biography of him is written. And that is what really breaks the story and is the basis upon which the movie is done, which again takes another, you know, 20 plus to almost 20 years, 18, 19 years to be made.
Right.
So, one thing I just want to comment is that, you know, you watch a movie and you know that a dramatic license is taken. So, there was controversy that came out with respect to the movie. Saying that, you know, this wasn't exactly right, or this wasn't exactly right. The story basically is told, and it's truthful. But little things such as they really make it very dramatic, the fact that Alan Turing was kind of a loner that wouldn't work well with the other people, and eventually did. The bottom line, he was much more collaborative than the movie led one to believe. In fact, to the extent that the letter that was sent to Winston was not just sent by him, but it was sent by the whole team.
Right.
But these are little things. So we're just not, when we, you know, I'm always I'm a stickler for facts. And I just want to point out that, you know, there's a few things like that, but it hardly detracts from this movie.
Right. Right. Oh, it's great. And, it's a great movie. And, you know, the campaign did work. Finally, they got Queen Elizabeth to pardon him. And they pardoned how many other people?
Well, I don't know how many were pardoned.
Thousands.
Remember, but
I think it's 20,000.
Thousands of them. Well, yeah, we're talking, you know, back in 2000, you know, whatever, early 2000s, when the pardon took place. What we have to understand is that you continue to be breaking the law until the mid-60s.
Yep.
So the law itself was not corrected to make homosexuality a criminal offense until, like, about 1966 or 67 in England.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got a long period of time here. And that's the reason they have, you know, obviously had these 20,000 individuals who were able to pardon. And so it's, yeah, that's a sad part of the story. And, you know, the thing is that when you mention him being a hero to the nerds, the fact is that his work, he's considered practically like the pioneer of computers.
He is the pioneer.
Because what he's the man. He's the one who did the trailblazing. At the beginning, with machines that now we look at and say, "Gosh, can't believe that they use something that archaic or old looking," but you have to start somewhere, and this is the man who did it.
Not just that, but I mean, we all grew up knowing the Turing test. You know, that was the
right. Yes,
we're still catching up with the guy. You know, we are now in 2017, and now this year we're finally getting to the point where AI, artificial intelligence, is a thing that really is going to happen. And it's his work that everybody is using daily. You know, his name is invoked all the time. They're talking about the Turing test. They got to sit in the test is, are you human? Or are you a machine? And that's what they're trying to, that's what the Turing test determines, is that's the test to see if it's real artificial intelligence. If you can't tell if it's a machine or human, then you've passed the Turing test. And so his name will live on for a long, long time because he's the guy who invented that test. And think about it. How can you think that theoretically at that time that this is going to happen?
Ooh. I mean, you don't even have the mechanism. You don't have the machinery. You don't have the computer to do it. But here's a man who's already thinking way ahead of the curve in this regard. So when you think about it being a pioneer for computers, he's also got this thing, when you say artificial intelligence, you can't describe its development without talking about Alan Turing.
Yes, yes. So that's the saving grace of this whole thing. And in that sense, he's immortal, and he didn't die, but under such terrible circumstances. So,
I'd say that this movie is this movie was up for 8 Academy Awards, won it for its screenplay. I just saw it a couple of days ago, and it's just overwhelmed. You're not going to find any, even though Leonardo DiCaprio was thought that he would be the man to play Alan Turing, it didn't work out that way, and which is fine because all the people in the movie, what's the name of the actor, Benedict Cumberbatch?
Yes,
is the one who plays Alan Turing, and he was up for an Academy Award. He didn't win it, but all the production. This is a $14 million budget, and it was back in 2014, grossed not domestically and internationally, well over $200 million. So this is a blockbuster movie in several regards. I mean, financially, it was an incredible success, and it's so polished.
Yes.
In terms of it, and it's so authentic
aspect.
Looking
yeah.
and period polished.
Oh,
it
God,
is
yeah.
just an amazing thing to watch, and so yeah, it was a great movie to watch, and I thoroughly recommend that that if you haven't seen this movie, yes, this is one where the movie shines brightly and does a great job of bringing forth the unsung hero.
Yeah.
In addition to obviously the biography did too.
And the history. And the history of the times, and a lot of kids these days don't really know as much as they need to about World War II and what happened. And I think these Holocaust museums and everything they set up all over, these things are important. You know, the Bletchley Museum, this is important. People need to remember in the case of the Holocaust so it doesn't happen again. In the case of Bletchley, that people never lose sight of the fact that you can solve extremely difficult problems if you put the resources together and get the right people, because it's people who solve these problems. And, you know, we have machines, we talk about the Turing test and all that stuff, but it's people, you know, working together, doing this stuff. Just a little side note here, John. 2 days ago, I'm talking to a neighbor of mine, and she says, well, you know, they have this son, they got like a genius son. And he said, well, he goes to school and all that stuff, but, you know, we supplement everything that he's learning. And one of the things we want him to, and then one of the problems with brainiacs is sometimes their emotions don't get fully developed because their brains are so powerful. So they take pains to make sure he has that side developed too. And she says, we're doing this little kind of mini course at home on heroes. He says, you have any good movies about heroes?
Funny you say that.
Yeah. And so I told her about Turing and the movie. And she said, wow. And I told her about Nicholas Winton. Double wow. And she said, you know, we had a lot of hero movies and stuff we wanted to watch with him, but none of them were true. I said,
yeah,
these are completely true. And, you know, you have to watch them. They're really wonderful. And then she was starting to go on a little bit about Alan Turing and what had happened to him, because she's one of us. She's a nice little nerdy lady. And so she goes on about it a little bit. And everybody, all technical people have emotions about this. And she was going on and ranting and raving. And she ends her little rant with, he was chemically castrated. Can you imagine castrated? And I said back to her, yeah. You know, I had it done. It wasn't chemically, but, you know. I know, you know, a little about what he went through, but his was much worse. They used some really crude form of estrogen, and he had terrible side effects. Terrible stuff. But anyway, funny how all these things weave together. Now, you may be wondering, how it is that John knows about so many great movies? Because that's what I get out of John. And this was one of the rare instances where I was able to turn him onto a movie. Right, John?
Oh, yes. But oh, yes, that's the case.
What's the list? What's the list people might want to be aware
of?
Well,
the thing is that we, you know, as you kind of go down the internet road, you always run into interesting side stories. And I noticed that The Imitation Game said it was at the top of the blacklist in 2011. And I said, what is the blacklist?
Yeah.
Well, it seems that back in 2005, a fella, I'll get his name here real quick, devised this list. Yeah, I've got it right here. His name's Franklin Leonard. Now, Franklin Leonard, back in 2005, was working for Universal as a development executive. A development executive is a guy who's supposed to take these unproduced movie scripts and see which ones are worthy of being made into movies. And the reason we're talking about this now is that we've talked about in the past about movies that, you know, the creativity has kind of been stifled because we have all these remakes and sequels, et cetera, et cetera. Well, and we talked about the fact that independent movies and, you know, are still have a platform. They can be shown at film festivals. Well, this is another way that we're able to break through and creativity takes place, because here's the way the blacklist works. What happens is this fella, Leonard Winston, what he will do is he sends out a questionnaire asking other people in his position, of which he figured back in 2005, he came up with a mailing list of about 90 guys who are familiar with unproduced scripts. And he said, what I would like you to do is send back to me what you feel are the 10 top unproduced scripts that you really like.
Wow.
And I like the way he couched this. He didn't say it like should be made in a movie.
Or make a lot of money.
The ones you like.
Yeah.
So when I went through this, I realized that not only was The Imitation Game the number one on his list in 2011, but guess what other movie popped up? King's Speech.
Uh-huh.
Which is a movie that we talked about.
Yeah.
Several, you know, episodes a couple ago. Podcasts ago.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is really an interesting way. Now, the way it got its name, number one, Franklin Leonard is black. So as a result, he says, I'm going to make a call. I'm going to call it the Blacklist. But he also did it for another reason, because he wanted to pay homage
yep.
to all of the people that were blacklisted from the movie production back during the McCarthy era, which took place in the early 50s. Many of not only we're talking actors and actresses, but more importantly, we're talking the creativity piece of it. The producers, the directors, the screenwriters, Dalton Trumbo is yep. Probably the classic example. A lot of times, how these guys in the Blacklist from the 50s got
fake,
back.
Fake
well,
names.
They hired them, and then they had to put them. They had to put fake
yep.
names to them.
And they had a whole cottage industry going. That's how they stayed alive. That's how they paid their bills.
Yeah, because they needed to work, and that's the way they were able to do it was just by going. Their name wasn't known. They gave them a goofy name that when you watch the movies, that can kind of be kind of a chuckler when you see some of the names
yeah,
that they use. Yeah, so the Blacklist plays into it, into this too. And I just thought it was kind of interesting that there is this method. Now, I want to point out that I don't want to overstate the Blacklist, because the point being that you say, well, these are unproduced scripts. Now, that doesn't mean that these are scripts that aren't owned by the major studios, because some of them are. But what's good about it is these studios who are holding these scripts now have a little bit of feedback, which can quite often make or break whether they make the decision to have this actually made
right.
into a movie. So I just thought it was kind of interesting that yes, creativity's out there, and it does have the method by which it can be exposed and be made into a movie. And this is just another way that it can happen.
I mean, how can somebody find it is listening?
You can wiki it and come up, just put Blacklist and it's listed on Wikipedia. Then you can then, and under, if you go to the website, it actually lists every movie that was put on the Blacklist since 2005. So you remember
yep,
a movie called
sure
Argo?
Do.
That's a classic example of a movie that was made that
yep.
it kind of fits the kind of stuff that we would think about. We talked about King's Speech, kind of untold stories or stories that are underneath the surface that haven't quite
yep.
hit the radar yet. And Argo is
yep.
another good example of that. I think I can quote this if I look, but I think it's something like 30% of the movies that are on the list end up, of the scripts, end up becoming actual
wow.
movies. So it's not only a list that's out there for fun, but it has actually proven to be a means by which these come to fruition and the movies are actually being made. So yeah, it's good and it's kind of fun. It says nearly a third of the movies on the list have been produced as theatrical
nice.
Films, including movies such as here's another one that I like. I don't know if you remember a really small movie called Slumdog Millionaire's on this.
Juno.
Love Juno. You remember Juno, the little movie? Yeah, and that was like Roger Ebert's. He just raved about it so much. I thought, Roger, lighten up a little bit. But he was right. I mean, it's a great quirky movie. I mean, the language, the way the girl talks. So
yeah.
the fact
that was
is,
her premiere movie, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I just thought of fun was just looking through the list was a trip. So the various lists from 2005 on. So I do recommend, taking a look at that, particularly if you're kind of like I am a movie nerd and are interested quite often in the background. This provides you with another piece of information. Two unsung heroes, which I'm glad
yeah.
we were able to talk about and tell their stories. This is the kind of thing that I think when it comes to, getting on the internet and taking a look and finding things. This is the rewarding part of it, is when you can find people out there like this. And the fact is that we're talking about two different types of activity. There's all kinds of things like this that we just don't realize is going on. And the good news is, in our information age, more of this is being, you know, lifted out of the recesses of hidden knowledge up to the point that we are learning more about it, which is
lifetime
learning. Very, very good.
Let's hear it.
Yes. All for that, believe me. A quest for knowledge is something that's a thirst which I don't think I'm ever going to be able to fully
satisfy.
That's a good
thing. Yeah.
Thankfully.
Exactly. Well, great time talking, John.
Yeah, all good. And I'm going to try to dry out this and be able to see another ball game this afternoon. But
fingers crossed.
We'll be fingers crossed and look forward to talking to them all then.